This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, hey, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and today's guest is one of our very own from right here in New Baltimore, Michigan. And I have to tell you, we are very fortunate because the state of Michigan has some absolutely rock-solid blues, rock, R&B, country. You name it, we've got it. We have gifted musicians on every level of the music genre list. So as I was saying, our guest today is one of those hard-working, talented musician who proudly calls Michigan their home. He's a singer and songwriter and an American rock blues musician. If you're a fan of SiriusXM's B.B. King's Bluesville, you might even catch some cuts from his 2024 album, Big Leg Woman, there. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome our guest, Michigan Mick. It's great to have you on Time Signatures. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Do you want to be called Jay Irvin or Irvin? Jim Irvin, what's your preference?
Irv is fine, man.
Irv, you got it. Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Glad to have you. So let's dig in here because we got a lot to talk about. I'd like you to talk about your earliest memories of music, Mick.
My earliest memories of music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my family wasn't really musically inclined. I had a couple of aunts that played a little piano. My mom, she sang in the church choir. And my dad would brag that he played the radio really well.
Okay.
So, anyway, well, though, I'm sorry?
No, I was just going to say, did you have any favorite songs or any bands, the ones that you just had to hear over and over again when you were a kid?
The way that kind of worked is that, my grandmother and my uncle lived with us. I grew up in a small rural area, a small farmhouse. And my uncle was about 7.5 years older than me, so I would hear the top 40, like Everly Brothers and, sure, Smokey Robinson, Nat King Cole, some of the early Motown, things like that. And I liked that. I liked it a lot. But
all right, Mick, talk about your baptism into the blues, man. Where did that start for you?
That started on a Sunday night. And I was playing up in the attic, and we had this old Zenith radio, mm-hmm, that would get UHF and VHF and Coast Guard and CB and, AM and FM. And it was a hot summer night. I think I was maybe about 7 years old. And I'm playing with this. It's making all those spooky sci-fi noises. And then I hear this gospel. This woman singing this phenomenal gospel. And it gives me goosebumps right now. Later on, I find out it's Mahalia Jackson. And then I'm hearing, Preaching Blues by Sunhouse, and wow, Golden Gate Jubilee Choir, and singing all these gospel songs. So that's where I really got my influence in with the music, with the blues and stuff. And sure, of course, later on in the week, I'm playing around with it, trying to find that again. Well, I don't find the gospel, but I started hearing Lowell Foles from Jimmy Reed, Sonny Terry, guys like that, and I was just hooked. And I'm listening to this stuff, really getting into it. But the one, and I'd hear some B.B. King or Albert King, but the one that got me was when I heard Freddie King. His guitar work just clinched it for me. So that was it. Even though my family really wasn't very musically inclined, wasn't into the blues, I heard that and I was hooked.
Now, at what point in your life did you decide that a career in music was going to be in the cards for you?
Once, really, but that fell through badly.
Okay.
I got a guitar. Begged my dad to get me a guitar, and so he buys me this guitar at Kmart that's not much more than a shoebox with a stick on it. It was brutal. it was bad. But one of the guys that was in Cub Scouts, he taught kids how to play guitar, so he came over to the house. He's showing me some stuff. Next week, he comes over and he brings this beautiful arch top orchestral Gibson guitar with heavy flat wound jazz strings. I mean, it was way better than the thing I was trying to play on.
Sure.
He said, here, use that. Didn't have a case. He said, take it around, put it in a pillowcase, you'll be fine. I mean, that guitar would be like 10 grand now if you had that thing. And I'm like 8.5, 9 years old dragging that thing around all over, you know, in a pillowcase, you know. Yeah, I could get a gunny sack and stick it in that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it. And I started playing. And the area I grew up in was, you know, a lot of wedding standards, country and western. And as I'm getting better, then one day I tell him about, you know, I start showing him a little boogie-woogie stuff that I'm trying to copy from what I'm hearing on the radio. He goes, oh. So he pulls out some other stuff, and he happened to be a closet bluesman himself, and his big fan was Freddie King, his big favorite. And so that was the magic. That was the magic. So, you know, like I said, it was an area that really didn't listen to what they called race music back then. But he was into it. I was into it. We were kind of playing those little things back and forth and so on. So when songs, you know, when Cream comes out and Hendrix come out in 66 and 67, all the kids are trying to play that. And they're like, well, how'd you get it so fast? Well, I was listening to their root. Instead of building from them, I was building from what they were building on. So I had a faster lead anyway, or a longer lead on those guys. So playing those types of things. So then that was what really got it going. And started playing from there. And my best friend, he started playing, got a high school band. His sister was a flight attendant. So she would get all these records that you couldn't get here in the States. Kind of like a reverse thing. You know, you hear about the Brits, you know, getting music from the States, you know, that they wouldn't get back and forth. So we got all this other stuff. So I'm listening to Savoy Brown, 10 Years After, Atomic Rooster, all before any of that stuff. Everybody else is listening to Cream and Hendrix and stuff, which is great. But then I'm listening to other stuff too and hearing other things like that. John McLaughlin, all that kind of stuff. So that was where I really got into it for a good deal. And playing a lot of electric, banging away. Had a drummer that was a Keith Moon fan. So, you know, we're thinking, we got it, you know. And we're playing, we had a gig before Christmas, and I got mad at my friend. So I didn't talk to him over the whole Christmas week. So then over the Christmas period, I got rid of all my electric stuff. He was like, what'd you do? So I got an acoustic. And so a week or two later, he gets rid of his, he gets an acoustic, the bass player. He goes, what are you guys doing? And we tell him, and the drummer quits. So we start getting into even more avant-garde type stuff, keeping some of the blues in there, but we were making blues, jazz, fusion type stuff like that. We really get into a lot of that stuff. And by the time I was 18, well, we were offered a contract right after we graduated high school, the three of us, with a company called Aquarian 00 Productions out of LA. And it was a subsidiary of the Hearst Corporation. And the other two guys, they were afraid to sign. I turned 18 and said, what are they going to do, sue me? So I signed, you know? I'm thinking, like, this is great. So we go in the studio, we're recording, doing all sorts of stuff. And it was a one-year contract with optional three-year renewal. Year comes up. Goes, yeah, we want to keep you? Yeah, I'll sign up. We want you. We start talking to Columbia Records. About 3-4 months later, we're over in Southfield at a studio. The sheriff comes in, the FBI comes in, arrests my manager, arrests his entourage or his associate.
Oh, my goodness.
He embezzled like $200,000 in 1974.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And so everything went in the can, in the litigation. I'm under contract. Nobody will touch me.
Oh.
And plus, disco's coming out. So they don't want to hear, you know, guys doing John McLaughlin, acoustic, jazz, fusion. You know. Oh, and the bass player that we had, unfortunately, he passed away about 10 years ago. But he became Reba McEntire's touring bass player for like 17 years.
Oh, my goodness.
So talking about musicians here in Michigan, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, I've been around the world. Well, I've been playing Mexico, throughout the States, Europe. And before I had my nerve injury in my arm about 4 years ago, I was good as some, better than most. And I'd say I'm kind of like middle of the road here in Southeast Michigan. So that gives you a clue as to how good everybody is here in comparison to other places around the world.
Yeah, there's a lot of big talent in the Metro Detroit area. I've been exposed to Johnny Rhodes, and I don't dare go down the road because I'm going to miss somebody, and then I'm going to be upset. And I have so much respect for the many, many musicians in the state. I better not start listing names here, but I want to turn the page because you headed down this road. You had some nerve injury a few years ago.
Yep.
But we got to talk about the 2024 album, Big Leg Woman. Okay. I got a few questions, but I want to start with, this is actually your first album. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes.
So you went at 1974, you said?
That would be December 74, when the whole thing went down.
So 50 years has passed, and you're finally now releasing an album for the first time. What took you so long? I'm just curious.
Okay, well, like I said, I was under contract.
Sure.
And I just thought the disco stuff was coming out, and I wasn't into it.
Okay.
So I went to college and I became an engineer. And over the course of my career as an engineer, it was extremely well. I retired in 2022 from engineering, and I was the global lead engineer for automotive pedestrian protection safety systems globally for the company I worked for the world, Asia, Pacific, North and South America, Europe.
Wow.
Anything that went through the design and the development and the interface with any of the customers, whether it was GM, Ford, Chery, BMW, Mercedes, came across my desk first before the release of the design, what the targets were, what we're going to do, along with management, program managers who run the budget. But from the technical aspect, that's where I finally ended up as an engineer on that. I was for 30 plus years, a specialist in automotive safety systems, seatbelts, airbags, that type thing. So
50 years, you let your dream sit.
I didn't really let it sit, because about 6-8 years after I got out of college, they started sending me different places. But I always took my guitar with me. I'd have a guitar that I could put in a gig bag, and I'd fly somewhere, I'd put in the overhead bin. And I could sit in my hotel room getting drunk, or I could look for a place to go sit in and jam. And that's what I did. And I jammed all over. Monterey, Mexico, Austin, Texas, Atlanta, Chicago, New York, Indianapolis, Columbus, wherever they sent me, over in Europe. In the 1990s, I was sent over to work for the company for about a year in Germany. And I was part of their advanced development team. I was the only American engineer on that group. You had the Germans and the Swedes and the Brits and the Spanish. I was the only one there. But this was north of Hamburg, about 10 miles north of Hamburg. And if your listeners are up on your Beatles history, where did the Beatles do all their warm-up before they hit the big time? In Hamburg, Germany.
I'll be
on the Reeperbahn, which is the entertainment and red light district.
Okay. Wow.
Yes. And so when I was there, I would go there. Now, I would not partake of any of the red light stuff, but the entertainment, the bars, the clubs, even one of the bars there, the top 10 club that the Beatles played at, was still there when I was there. So I don't know if the same stage, but the same building, same location. I would play
and,
there.
And the blues at that time was pretty much coming into another resurgence, was it not?
Yes, it was. It wasn't so much here in the States. Well, it was to some degree. But over in
more
Germany.
More so in you. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. This would be like 97 to 99. Yes, that became really, really big. I wound up sitting in with an R&B band that had a horn section, a couple of girl singers, a couple of lead singers, guitar, bass, drums, keys. And I sat in with them, and they wanted me to join their band. I said, well, I got a wife and kids. I make me way more money than you guys do, but I appreciate it. But what they did do was they would invite me to their higher-end gigs in Paris or Amsterdam, Gothenburg, London, Hammond, England, stuff like that. And I had the frequent flyer miles, so they'd send me a cassette. I practiced some new tunes. we booked there, and I didn't even worry about getting paid. They just put my name up there. And that's how I got my stage name. The lead singer there started calling me Michigan Mick, because my name is Michael, and everybody there is Michael, and they're calling Mick. And you can't throw a stone without hitting a Mick. I mean, we're lousy. We're all over the place. Doesn't matter. England, Germany, Ireland. You say Mick, and there's 15 hands that go up at once, you know? So they started calling me Michigan Mick, so they would bill me. The name of the band was called Groover, with special guest Michigan Mick. And they would love it, because every time they billed it with special guest Michigan Mick, they said they'd fill the house, because everybody thought, oh, we got this Yank that's playing, coming over from the States, playing with this band. They didn't know who I was, but it was just the hype of it. So it was fun.
Very cool.
We did that for about a year or so, and we played this place called The Boulevard down in Havant, England. And who walks in? Alvin Lee. After the show, he and I sat there and jammed for all night. The bartender closed up the place. Me and him, a couple other people, are playing all night long. He's drawing drafts off the, you know, and having a blast. It was fun.
So, wow. Those are the kind of stories I love to hear, man. I just, it's so exciting to hear that kind of stuff. Now, I want to return to the album. Sure. I happen to know that you worked with Motor City Josh at the Sound Shop on this project.
Yes,
I did. For those watching and listening, Josh is also a very well-known musician. As I said, Motor City Josh is what he goes by. Yes. Of Motor City Josh and the Big Three. And I need to get this guy in this program soon, because I keep interviewing musicians that have worked with him, and I owe him that much. So talk about the relationship that you forged with Josh and the Sound Shop.
Okay, well, actually, Josh and I forged our relationship back in the early 1990s.
Okay.
During the 1980s, I had some blues-worthy hard times, stuff that I really don't want to even talk about, pretty depressing.
Sure.
And I put the guitar down for a while. Well, my one boy got me back into playing, so I go out there and start getting my chops back. And there was this little dumpy bar in Mount Clemens called Chrissy's. It's now called Three Blind Mice.
Okay.
And they would have open jams on Thursday nights, so I would go there, and that's where I met Josh, with Curtis Sumner and some other musicians. And Josh and I hit it off really well. This is like about 1992. And we've been good friends since then. And so even though I may not see him for a year or two or three, we get together instantly. It's the same type of camaraderie that as if I had seen him yesterday.
Yep.
And so with the album, I decided I'd make an album. And I gave him a holler and said, how about if I record that? Help me get some studio musicians. I gave him the raw tracks, worked out the arrangements, got the musicians in, and recorded the album.
Wow. Now, I have to ask you.
Sure.
You get the album done. You get it mm-hmm. produced. You send it off.
Yep.
The first time you heard one of your songs on Sirius XM's Bluesville, how did that feel, man? And does it ever get old?
No, it doesn't get old. Not at all. And I don't know if I could even say it, but because my thought was, get the F out of here. Are you kidding me? Really? That's when I didn't even hear it. I was told about it. I said, really? And so when I finally heard it, yeah, I had to, you know, tell my wife, tell my kids, tell my brothers, you know, tell everybody, my friends. Oh, yeah, look, and post it all over Facebook at the same time, too. It's like, it's one of those magic moments, like, oh my gosh, that's great.
And it's not just a hit or miss, is it?
No. It's rolling along. It gets about 2.5-3 spins a day, and it's been running like that since December 15th or 18th, something like that.
That's crazy. That is crazy.
Yeah, I'm pleased that it is, though. I'm grateful for that.
Now, I've been told that you have another local musician on this album. You also allowed her to record one of your songs on her new album.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
First of all, talk about who that is and how did that come about?
Okay, her name is Sunny Blue, and I met her and Nick Coco about 2.5 years ago. We met at the Detroit Blues Society International Blues Competition for like 2024 or something like that. And neither of us made it with the DBS. I actually wound up representing the West Michigan Blues Society, and to go down to Memphis, and she became part of the Women in the Blues program. So we were down there in Memphis at the same time. Okay. And just built up a good camaraderie on it. So I write this song called Forevermore, and how I write these songs is, you know, it's because I got a glass of bourbon and a cigar and I'm in the garage, you know, when it's hot in summer, and I'm just noodling away. And I come up with this kind of interesting Latin kind of groove, write the music, and I'm thinking, this is kind of almost like a feminine type of lyric. I'm thinking it needs like a woman's touch to add something in there. Mm-hmm. So I gave her a holler and I said, hey, you want to do some duet on this? And she says, yeah. So we put it out there, and the Detroit Blues Society, when they did their CD review earlier this January, they really, really dug that song. They think that's another one that needs to go on Bluesville ASAP.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice. And then the song that she recorded of yours, I'd like to hear the story on that too. She modified it, didn't she?
Yes. Yeah. And I'm glad she. You know, I think they should. I think people should. They shouldn't try to copy me or whatever like that. They should put their own spin to it. I went over to their place, Nick and Kelly's place, and we were talking about music. And Nick's telling me about, you know, because I'm planning on doing the album. This is even before I lay down any tracks. I said, well, you got to take care of your label. You got to take care of your publishing and stuff like that. So I look at the stuff. I go, I'm a smart man, but not smart enough. So I had to get an attorney to get that stuff going. So created my own label, created my own publishing. That lawyer kind of fell down for a while, but things kind of finally got straightened out last month or so. But that was like 6-7 months in the making trying to get this stuff squared up. So anyway, that's how, you know, I started. They said, we need some more songs for our, we have a record label that wants us to present more songs, and we need something. So I showed them Forevermore. I showed them Regret Blues. Showed them a couple other songs, and they decided to cover Regret Blues, call it Regretful Blues, and put their spin on it, which I think mm-hmm. was great.
And how did that feel, you know, seeing that come to fruition on another album like that?
I was humbled. I was really humbled to think that somebody would think that one of the songs that I wrote was worth their time to record. I was very humbled, very grateful for that, because, you know, those are the types of things that I aspired to when I was 18, 19 years old.
Sure. Yeah.
So 15 years later, I was like, wow. And that's, and like I said, I was very humbled by that.
Now, Mick, aside from Bluesville, aside mm-hmm. from DBS, yep. how has Big Leg Woman been received thus far? Any awards or nominations for awards have come down your way yet?
Yeah, it's up for the Michigan Music Association Awards. That's, I guess, it's being held this Sunday. Best Blues Album and the song Big Leg Woman, Best Blues Song. So it's up there along with Sunny Blue and the Moons and Lexi Blue and some other, you know, great blues musicians. So there's a whole bunch of us there that are up there. But yeah, I got nominated, and I was surprised because I didn't even know it was out there, and somebody threw my CD in the. They probably meant to throw it in the trash, and they actually threw it over there in the award bin instead. They go, oh, okay, we'll put this one there too.
Well, now I have to ask you the follow up question: Has sure. the release of this album made you hungry for more? As in, any plans in the near future for another album?
Yes, I'd like to do one more studio and at least one live. Something like okay. that, compilation of the two studio albums. There's a song on the album called "Serving My 99," which
yes,
a lot of people like, but they also find it a little dark. The lyrics and so on. It's kind of when they talk about it, go, I really like that song, but you know the lyrics are kind of dark, and I go, I suppose so. And that song came up as a last minute kind of thing. It was like the getting ready to do the last mix on the album. I had 10 songs
mm-hmm.
and I'm just listening to stuff, and I wind up writing this song like 2 days before I go into review the final mix. We do the mix, everything's all good. And I asked Josh, I said, hey, let me just put this down. So I've got a nice recorded copy. He goes, sure. So run the mic, whammo. I run it through the first time down. He listened to it and goes, why don't you put on the album? Okay. Does a little mix. I think from the time we recorded, the time it was mixed, couldn't have been half hour. So we put that song on there. And, excuse me, and it's been getting a lot of local attention. People are, they really like it. But like I said, they find it a bit difficult because of the darker lyrics in this song, you know?
Well, here's the most important question of the day, Mick. Where can folks go to find out more about Michigan Mick, maybe buy some copies of the album, merch if you have it available, or maybe even to book you for a gig?
They can book me for a gig. They can check me up on Facebook. Another thing that I'm learning that I'm woefully deficient in a whole bunch of things, such as I don't have a website, which I'm getting that worked up.
Well, and I have to be honest with you. I've listened to your album a few times through, and mm-hmm. I've enjoyed it. There's definitely some good material there, and you do have copies of the album available.
Yes.
Available for streaming, I would assume, as well.
Yes, it's on all Amazon, Apple, Spotify. It's on all the stream, Pandora. Okay. It's everywhere. Fortunately, last week I got heads up that Radio Caroline, the pirate radio station in the UK, will be playing my album starting April.
Nice.
Yes, so, and they are an AM station, which has about four times the range as FM. So they're not only getting the UK, but they're getting the whole western coast of Europe.
Wow.
So
wow.
Yeah, so that gets into their stream come April.
Michigan Mick, it has indeed been a pleasure, sir. I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk to me today. Greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Had a blast. Thank you.
And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Michigan Mick, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Riven reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.